So our world is full of pain and suffering. Rarely does a month go by without news of another school shooting, a massive terrorist attack, or a devastating natural disaster. In addition to events like these, which grab the world's attention, there are also the sufferings which don't make the headlines. For all of you who are future medical professionals, these sufferings are part of your daily life. The young mother battling cancer, the elderly man who no longer recognizes his wife because of dementia, the survivor of rape who comes to the ER. As future doctors, you are called to tend to the myriad of ways in which human beings suffer through their bodies and minds. It's a privilege to be with you tonight to talk to you about how that suffering fits with the reality of God and his goodness. So the obvious fact that our world includes much suffering of many different kinds is the starting point of one of the oldest and most compelling arguments against the existence of God. The argument known as the problem of evil goes as follows, and this is on your handout labeled as the atheistic argument on page 1. If there's a God, then there can be no evil, but there is evil, therefore there is no God. Why, you might ask, is the existence of God incompatible with evil? Well, if God is supposed to be all-knowing, as the traditional religions say, then God would be aware of all the evils happening in the world. For example, God would know about the first emergence of the cancer cells before they can grow into an uncontrollable tumor. Furthermore, if God is all-powerful, God would be able to stop all evil. An omnipotent being like God could wipe out not only terrorists, but also ailments like cerebral palsy. And finally, if God is supposed to be all good, as religious people say, God would want to stop the evils in our world. You and I are not infinitely good as God is supposed to be, but even we would want to end the suffering that your patients experience if only we were able. So if God is the sort of being who would know about all evil, be able to stop all evil, and would want to stop all evil, then it follows that if there were a God, all evil would have already been eliminated. But clearly there is still evil in our world. Therefore, it seems that there cannot also be an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good God. So variations of this argument that I just made have been put forth by philosophers and theologians for centuries in attempt to undermine belief in God. And religious believers have come up with their share of responses to the argument. Some religious believers see no tension between the existence of God and the presence of evil in our world because they see the suffering that befalls human beings as justly willed punishments for sin. Pat Robertson, a former presidential candidate and prominent Christian televangelist, has expressed this very view. A few years back on his TV show, The 700 Club, he said the following, and this quote's on page 1 of your handout. Quote, every time the United States gets involved in some kind of pressure on Israel to split their land, there's some natural disaster that happens here in America. If the United States pressures Israel to try to give up half of Jerusalem, God himself is going to come against this nation. Watch it. End quote. In Robertson's view, God has caused natural disasters to happen in the U.S. to punish our nation for its role in the Middle East peace talks. From Robertson's perspective, there's no incompatibility between the existence of the Christian God and evil in this world. It doesn't follow from God's goodness, in his view, that God wants to stop evil. Rather, God wills the particular evils that we find in our world to punish people for their sins. Since God does not punish unjustly, we can surmise that people who suffer much have sinned much, and much more greatly than those whose lives include less suffering. In tonight's talk, I want to look to the great philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas for wisdom on the question of why there is evil in our world, given that the world as a whole is a creation of a good God. In particular, we're going to look at what Aquinas has to say about the question of why God allows human beings to suffer, given that he particularly loves and cares for each individual human being. Aquinas rejects the atheistic conclusion that evil disproves the existence of God. Aquinas thought that we can know with certainty that God exists. God is what explains why there's something rather than nothing. If we deny that God exists, we're left with no explanation for why the world around us exists rather than nothing at all. While Aquinas was firmly convicted of God's existence, he also rejected the view that all suffering is meted out by God as punishment for one's sins. In Aquinas' view, God doesn't meddle in nature to cause evils to happen in particular places to sinful people. Rather, he allows the creatures he made to act through their powers, and this sometimes results in another creature's suffering. In what follows, we'll see how Aquinas thought God's permission of his creatures' operations through which they cause suffering to one another was itself an expression of God's goodness and reconcilable with the particular love and care God has for each of his human creatures. So section 2, what is evil and where does it come from? So I'm not going to refer to the handout very much here, but the main points are summarized on there from this section. So to understand Aquinas' thinking about why there's evil in a world made by a good God, we first have to consider his views about what evil is and where it comes from. Aquinas' conception of what evil is, or rather, what it's not, is strikingly different from how we in the modern world tend to think of evil. We tend to identify evil with some sort of positive force that inclines humans towards acts of malice, or inclines natural entities such as tornadoes toward the destruction of human life and property. I don't want to imagine what that would be like, tomatoes destroying human life and property. By contrast, the majority of ancient and medieval thinkers denied that evil was something positive. So this is a very striking view. In their view, the term evil doesn't pick out some force or positive characteristic which all evil things have in common. Rather, what it means to say something is evil or bad for them is that it is missing or lacking some good that it ought to have. Blindness is a common example used to illustrate the point. Blindness is not some positive thing that gets added to a person. Rather, it's a lacking of sight. Let's consider another example. Consider bad cars. Think of all the ways in which a car can be bad. Bad cars can describe a car with failing brakes, that skids instead of stops, or a car with a failing carburetor, that delays when it's supposed to accelerate, or a bad car can be one with a body deteriorated from rust. The term bad doesn't pick out a list of positive features that all bad cars share in common. Rather, the reason we call these cars bad is because they are missing or lacking a proper order or functioning that a car ought to have. This can be applied to sickness and health. Health is what we call the proper ordering or function of an organic body. Illness is not some evil quality that's supposed to be super added to a body. Rather, it's a lacking of that proper order and functioning which a body ought to have. There is no one single quality that all ill people have in common. What all people who are ill have in common is a lack of proper bodily functioning. Aquinas and his medieval counterparts thought that getting the point straight that evil is a lacking rather than something positive was of utmost importance from distancing God from the responsibility for evil. If evil is itself a positive reality, then it seems that it has to have been brought into existence by God, since God is the creator of everything that exists. The ancient Manichaeans tried to reject the conclusion by positing that in addition to the good God, there was a supreme evil being who brought evil into existence. But if evil is not something positive, then it doesn't need God or any other cause to bring it into existence. Everything real is made by the one true God, and everything real is good. Evil is a lack of good, which ought to be there. So not just any lack is an evil. So I lack wings, for example. That's not evil for me to lack wings, because it's not something a human ought to have. But if I were lacking an arm or lacking in sight, that's what the ancient and medieval authors would call an evil, since these are things that a human ought to have. So you might be thinking right now that it makes sense to think of illness as a lack of health or blindness as a lack of sight, but there's this deeper problem. What about the experience of pain? How can that be a lacking? When someone has pain, it seems like they have something added there, not that they're lacking something. And then also there's the question, what about the positive entities in the body that are the underlying causes of illness? So like bacteria or tumors, for example, they don't seem to be lackings. They seem like things added there that shouldn't be there. So let's start by discussing pain. None of us like to feel pain, of course. So we might hastily judge that pain is an evil. But if we take a step back and look at the bigger picture of how the human body functions, pain is actually good for us. Pain in our bodies is a sophisticated warning system which alerts us that our body is currently being damaged. So you all probably know a lot more than I do about this, but with my students, when I teach them about this idea, I sometimes will show them a little YouTube clip about people who suffer from this condition. I don't remember what it's called, but I'm sure some of you know, where they don't feel pain and they get all sorts of bodily damage. They can scratch their eyes out. They can, I've heard of a runner who had it and just couldn't feel when like lactic acid was building in their muscles and they just run until they collapsed. So pain, it isn't an evil. It's something that we need for our body. It's part of our proper functioning. But let's think about the other hard case, the underlying causes of illnesses, the physical causes of illnesses. So consider a cancerous tumor, a strand of bacteria. Clearly, bacteria and tumors aren't lackings or privations. There's something positive in the body which causes a lack of health. So if the tumor and the bacteria are positive beings that are evils, then it seems that it can't be that all evils are privations. So in response to such a concern, I think Aquinas would try to argue that tumors and bacteria are not, in fact, evil beings. They simply are living cells or living organisms. So if we isolate them in petri dishes, for instance, we wouldn't be inclined to describe them as evils. The reason we think bacteria or clusters of rapidly dividing cells are evils is because they deprive the human body of its order and proper functioning. It's relative to us and what they do to us and our bodies that we call them evil. But considered merely in themselves, they're not evils. In Aquinas' view, the evils that are suffered by one creature are often caused by another creature seeking its own perfection. So the bacteria seeking its perfection, its flourishing, causes suffering in our body, causes a lack of health in us. The good of one creature often requires the destruction of another. As Aquinas often points out, the preservation of the lion's own life, so a lion is his usual example, a lion and a lamb, he didn't know about bacteria, for example. So the good of the lion requires the destruction of the lamb. In order for there to be all these different kinds of creatures in existence, in Aquinas' view, some creatures have to suffer evils for others to flourish. So their goals and their goods are at odds with each other. So you might ask, well, why did God create, all these different things if there's going to be conflicts between them? That, setting up a world with all these different kinds of things, E. coli, lambs, lions, you're creating a world where there's going to be suffering. So you need some account of why God would want to do this, make all these different kinds of things. So Aquinas thinks that the reason why God created anything at all was to communicate his goodness to creatures and to have his own goodness represented in creation. And in his view, no one creature by itself can adequately represent the goodness of God because God's goodness is infinite. Every creature has only a finite, limited set of perfections. What is lacking from one creature's perfection is represented by another. So for example, a beautiful sunset reveals something of God's grandeur that isn't manifested by a dog or a snail. Yet as living beings, dogs and snails reveal something of God's own life and power that we don't see in the sunset. So Aquinas thought that a world which contains multiple different kinds of beings is a better world than a world that's populated by just one highest type of creature, so a world of just angels, for example. He thinks that the existence of things like lions contribute to the overall goodness of the universe as a representation of God, even though this requires that some lambs have to be eaten. Aquinas acknowledges that, in a way, it can be said that God indirectly wills that evils be suffered because he wills the good of the whole, that there's this whole array of things that represents his goodness, even though as a byproduct there's going to be conflicts and harm caused from one creature onto another. So let's move on to section 3 and talk a little bit about some of Aquinas' specific thoughts about human beings and the evils they suffer. So the big picture we've seen so far of Aquinas' views can lead us to wonder whether God cares about the flourishing of individual creatures. So we've heard God wills for there to be a universe as a whole that perfectly represents God's goodness, and this in turn requires for some individual creatures to suffer evil at the hands of other creatures. So it seems that God's willing of the whole is at odds with his willing the good of each individual creature. So to take the lion and the lamb example, how can God's making a universe in which there are lions fit with his willing that, you know, a particular deer or lamb, Bambi, flourishes? Or for an even more difficult question, how can God's creation of universe, which includes E. coli, fit with his loving care of the individual people who suffer death from it? So we've heard that, you know, things like the lion or the bacteria that harms us, they represent in some way, maybe hard for us to understand how, the goodness of God, something of God's nature. But the big question is, you know, can God care about individuals while also having this goal that they're just all these things that represent his goodness and there are these conflicts between them? What about the individuals who suffer in those conflicts? According to Aquinas, God doesn't just create a bunch of creatures and then leave them to their own devices to work out how the history of the world unfolds. Aquinas thinks that God governs the world through his providence. This means that the details about the world, such as how many individual creatures there are, when they come into and go out of existence, and what actions they do, are established by God's wisdom. The goal that God aims for in establishing the order of creation is also his own goodness. He wants to best communicate his own goodness to creation. Creatures like us with intellects are able to fulfill the general goal of creation in a special way because we are able to know and love God and exist in an eternal union with him. Everything which exists in the universe and everything which happens is arranged by God for the sake of us, intellectual creatures, reaching the final goal of union with God. Aquinas goes so far as to claim that all the other creatures that God has made in the material universe exist for the sake of humans reaching this goal. Not only do plants and trees and animals allow us to sustain our bodies by providing food, clothing, shelter, they also, and for Aquinas more importantly, they're instruments by which we know God. So all of you, when you study the body and, you know, other things about nature and the world and your sciences, Aquinas thinks that nature is more perfectly fulfilling its role when through your intellect you start to contemplate and know God through doing science. That's kind of the more important function of the natural world, not just giving us food and shelter. So the fact that non-intellectual creatures exist for the sake of contributing to the good of intellectual creatures impacts how God regards them in his providence. No particular individual of another species is necessary for humans to flourish. For instance, your body can be nourished by a hamburger made from any cow. You don't depend particularly on Bessie the cow to live. Similarly, you can contemplate God's grandeur in a mountain range. One exact mountain isn't necessary for you to attain that good. So since no particular non-intellectual creature is necessary for the good of the universe as a whole, that is, for creatures like us with intellects to reach union with God, God's providence over creation doesn't work towards the good of this or that particular non-intellectual creature. God hasn't ordered the universe toward the good of Bambi, the deer, or Cecil, the lion. The other lions and deers that will replace them can contribute the very same goods that they contribute to the universe as a whole. Aquinas thought that God's providence relates to us human beings in a very different and very special way. God doesn't order the world merely so that the human species has what it needs to continue on. God's providential order also seeks to bring each and every individual human being to his or her final goal, which is an eternal knowing and loving union with God in the afterlife. Unlike other creatures in the material universe, humans exist solely for the sake of reaching this final goal for ourselves. We don't exist to sustain another animal as the lamb does for the lion. We don't exist so that angels might contemplate God in us. Your bodily health and your moral virtues, for example, they're for your own sake and for your good only, not for some higher being in the universe to use those goods in you. So we can ask, if God has this special care over human beings, why does God allow humans to suffer and die if there's no higher species which needs to make use of us humans for themselves? Why doesn't God prevent individual humans from suffering evils if human suffering is not necessary for another creature? So Bambi has to suffer for the lion to live. But we're not like that. We're not ordered to something else's good. So why do we suffer then? According to Christian theology, it wasn't God's initial plan that we should suffer bodily death and corruption. According to Christianity, God created the first human beings in a state called original justice. God gave the first humans special gifts that we don't naturally have by our nature. Through a special gift, the first human intellects had perfect command over their behavior, and they possessed every moral virtue. Their souls were so powerful in this state that they were able to prevent the bodies that they enlivened from suffering corruption and death. When the first human beings sinned, they rejected God's rule, and with that, they also rejected the special gifts that they had been given by God. With the rejection of these supernatural gifts, human beings were no longer preserved from death and physical suffering. It's natural that material bodies eventually break down and corrupt, and it was only through this special strengthening of our soul through God's power that we were spared this natural breaking down of our bodies. In response to original sin, God wills human beings to have the consequences that follow from their choice to reject God's gifts. This isn't, of course, God's ultimate will. God also willed to send Christ in the world with a plan to reconcile humans to himself. But the important point to take away is that evil suffered by human beings isn't something that God indirectly willed for the good of the universe as a whole. That is, our suffering is a byproduct of the choice of the first parents to commit original sin. But our bodily corruption and the natural death that we suffer, these clearly aren't the only sorts of evils humans suffer. As we see in the news every day, humans suffer from violence, car accidents, natural disasters, bodily diseases. And it seems that God could allow our bodies to naturally break down and die as a consequence of original sin, while still setting up and ordering the universe in such a way to prevent diseases, accidents, violence, and natural disaster. So why doesn't God providentially arrange the universe to save us from all this additional evil, which goes beyond natural bodily corruption and death? Aquinas addresses this question most poignantly in his biblical commentary on the book of Job. For those who are unfamiliar with the story, Job was a just man who was always careful to avoid doing evil. He was very wealthy and had a large family. In the story, Satan appears before God and claims that Job has only lived an upright life because he has been blessed with so much and has faced so little adversity. Satan thinks that if Job were to experience some real suffering, he would no longer be so faithful to God. So God permits Satan to test Job's virtue. In the course of the story, Job's livestock, servants, and children are all killed in quick succession. And then Job himself is afflicted with a painful illness. Job's friends hold the view, which we heard earlier in the talk from Robertson, that all evil is punishment for sin. They tell Job that he must have done something really terrible to have deserved all this suffering which he has received. Throughout the story, Job maintains his innocence, and eventually he is vindicated. Aquinas' commentary on this book of the Bible provides us an opportunity, or provides him with an opportunity, to reflect on the question of what the reasons or causes are for why innocent people suffer. Aquinas writes in his commentary on Job, and this is text 1 on the first page at the bottom on your handout. "One thing which seems most severe is that the innocent experience many adversities in this life, besides the death which is common to all. It seems reasonable that the innocent, who are not guilty of their own sins, should not be inflicted with any other punishment besides the death which is due to original sin," end quote. From various passages from throughout Aquinas' commentary on Job, and some from some other works, we can piece together his response to the question of why God allows innocent people to suffer evils beyond bodily corruption and death. Aquinas' basic thesis is that God allows people to suffer because he can work a greater good out of their suffering. Aquinas often repeats the following quote from Augustine, and this is text 2 on page 2 of the handout at the top. Quote, "Almighty God would in no wise permit evil to exist in his works unless he were so almighty and so good as to produce good even out of evil. The greater good that God works from human suffering is not for the universe as a whole, or not for some higher creature in the universe. The greater good God works out of Bambi's suffering is for the lion, but the greater good that God works for the suffering of human beings is, in Aquinas' view, for humans themselves. In order to understand what sort of greater goods Aquinas has in mind, it's important to remember how Aquinas sees the goal of human life. In our modern society, we tend to think of the goal of human living as getting those things that will bring us pleasure and honor in this world. Delicious food, good entertainment, the residency you want, honors in your career, a nice house, a good spouse, perhaps successful, well-behaved children. This is how we conceive of the good life. Now, Aquinas doesn't deny that these things are in fact good. No, those all really are good things. But in his view, these goods are neither necessary nor sufficient for achieving the true purpose for why we exist. Even with those worldly goods, our hearts will always desire something more. Aquinas thinks that the true satisfaction of our desires, that is our true happiness, lies in achieving union with God in the next life. In order to reach this goal, we must be transformed into the sort of people who will freely love God. According to Aquinas, God at times permits suffering and trials to happen to a person because God knows that through these trials, a person will grow in the virtues that enable her to be more fully united to God in the next life. Aquinas writes, and this is text 3 on page 2, quote, "Now it happens that God sometimes permits trials or even some spiritual defects to happen to some to obtain their salvation. As Romans says, all things work together for the good of those who love God. In this way, God comes to man to obtain his salvation, and yet man does not see him because he cannot perceive his kindness." End quote. Notice the last line of this quote. Aquinas points out that oftentimes we cannot see the good that is happening for us through our trials. We ordinarily don't see the suffering and trials we face as God's kindness, but that's how Aquinas is trying to see it. We often pray to God to take away the suffering we experience. God, however, permits the suffering to continue since he sees it as working for our good. The goal of God's providence is not to preserve us from earthly troubles and suffering. Rather, in Aquinas' view, God's goal is to get us to heaven. Aquinas writes the following about the way in which God responds to the prayers of those who suffer. And this is text 4. Quote, "For God sometimes does not hear someone's prayer according to what he wishes, but according to what actually succeeds. Just like a doctor does not heal the plea of the sick man who asks him to take away the bitter medicine, if the doctor does not remove the remedy he knows to be health-inducing, he nevertheless hears the actual advantage of the plea of the patient because he induces health, which the sick person greatly desires. God does not take away trials from a man set down in the midst of a trial, although he prays for mercy, because he knows that trials are useful to final salvation. Thus, although God truly heeds him, nevertheless, the man who sat down in the midst of miseries does not believe that he is heard. For if an afflicted man should understand the reason why God afflicts him, and that the afflictions are useful to his salvation, clearly he would believe that his prayer had been heard. But because he doesn't understand this, he does not believe that his prayer has been heard." End quote. Again, in this passage, Aquinas emphasizes that God permits humans to suffer since the suffering is useful for their salvation. God is not in the business, in Aquinas' view, of securing worldly pleasures, even freedom from physical pain for us. What he's after in his providence is securing each human's salvation. Both of the passages we just heard from Aquinas suggest that we ourselves might not be able to tell when suffering is working for our ultimate good. Aquinas doesn't think that human beings can, in many cases, know the particular goods that come out of the particular evils that God permits. Yet he thinks that we can, at a more general level, understand how certain types of goods can emerge from experiencing certain types of evil. Here are some examples Aquinas gives. Through experiencing one's weakness, one can grow in humility. Through experiencing persecution, one can grow in patience. Through being opposed, one can grow in wisdom. And by being treated with animosity, one can grow in benevolence. Aquinas's point is that by being put into situations where we are tested and tried, we develop the inward dispositions needed to flourish as a human being. So some of this can seem almost, hard to connect with the real experiences that we see of people suffering. You know, it seems okay, and maybe even in the abstract, but, you know, how does this work for real people? So I want to share just a couple examples of people telling their story and how they experience some of the things Aquinas is saying from their suffering. So one modern day example of someone who personally believes that she received great goods through her suffering is a woman named Joni Erickson Tada. She's the founder and CEO of an organization called Joni and Friends, which provides support for those living with disabilities. So when she was 17, she suffered a diving accident that left her permanently paralyzed and without the use of her hands. She wrote the following in her book, When God Weeps. She's written several books. She also, very interestingly, is a painter. She's developed a way to put a paintbrush in her mouth and makes art and sells it as well. She's quite remarkable. She writes, quote, "Before my paralysis, my hands reached for a lot of the wrong things. My feet took me into some very bad places. After my paralysis, tempting choices were scaled down considerably. My diving accident was the beginning of a long, arduous process of becoming like Christ," end quote. She goes on to write, quote, "Hardships have forced me to make decisions about God. Suffering has done a job on my character. I'm not so sloppy about relationships. I stick to promises. I'm more patient. People matter more," end quote. No one likes to suffer, of course, but there are others like Joni who have similar stories of being transformed by their suffering into better friends, siblings, neighbors, and spouses. In a few minutes, I'll share another first-person story like that. So why is it that suffering has the unique power to transform us into better versions of ourself? Why isn't there an easier way besides suffering to develop virtues and to become the kind of people who will freely love God? In his book, God in the World, Pope Benedict XVI describes suffering as the inner side of love. He writes, quote, "Anyone who really wanted to get rid of suffering would have to get rid of love before anything else. Because there can be no love without suffering, because love always demands an element of self-sacrifice, because given temperamental differences and the drama of situations, love will always bring with it renunciation and pain," end quote. In learning how to inwardly embrace suffering, we become more capable of setting ourselves aside for others, an act of love. So in Pope Benedict's words, quote, "It is so important to learn how to suffer," end quote. To learn how to suffer is to learn how to love, how to set ourselves aside. It seems that Aquinas thought that the goods that come from suffering, they don't always go to the one who undergoes the suffering. So he says, in addition to the sufferer being transformed by suffering, he says some suffering happens for other people who aren't the ones suffering to be transformed. So he says in the commentary on Job that sometimes innocent people are permitted to suffer because the very way in which they respond to their suffering serves as an example to inspire others. Aquinas believes that scripture reveals that Job himself was permitted to suffer so that he could model for others, even for us today, how to bear suffering with patience. The present day life of Immaculée Ilibagiza provides a good example of how a person's heroic response to suffering can inspire others to great virtue. How many of you have heard of her? It's a great autobiography. So Immaculée was a college student in Rwanda when a genocide broke out against her people. For a period of several months, she hid in a 12-square-foot bathroom with seven other women. When she emerged from the bathroom, she was weighed just 65 pounds. She learned that nearly her entire family had been massacred when she emerged as well. Eventually, she came face to face with the man who killed her mother and one of her brothers. She did what many of us would consider unthinkable. She visited her family's killer in prison to offer her forgiveness. She went and found him so she could personally extend her forgiveness. So today, Immaculée speaks around the world about her experiences, and she writes in her book about an experience she had after one of the talks she gave in Atlanta. So an elderly woman came up to her. The elderly woman who came up to her, her very own parents were killed in the Holocaust when she was a baby. And this is what she said to Immaculée, quote, "Hearing your story about what you lived through and were able to forgive has inspired me. I've been trying my whole life to forgive the people who killed my parents, and now I think I can do it. I can let go of my anger and be happy," end quote. This story illustrates Aquinas' thought about how suffering which is permitted to one person can bring great goods to others as well. Through the suffering permitted to Immaculée, others were given a model of heroic virtue. One might wonder, though, whether it's really just for God to allow a person to suffer the loss of their wealth, their health, their family, even, just so that another person can benefit. Is it really just for God to allow a good and upright woman, like Immaculée, for example, to become afflicted in such a terrible way, or for one of your patients, for example, to be afflicted by a disease, just so that their shallow friends, for example, might be converted by the grace and patience by which they bear their illness? Is this fair to let one suffer so others can benefit from the example? Aquinas has a tough answer to this. He says, since our temporal blessings, so by temporal blessings he means things that are like goods of this world, health, wealth, family, these are gratuitous gifts from God. They're not things that God owes us. So in his view, we have no just complaint if God gives them to us just for a very short time and not for the entirety of our lives. Aquinas writes, and this is text 5 on the handout, quote, "Man does not have a just complaint with God if he should be despoiled of his temporal goods, because he who gave freely could bestow them either till the end of this life or temporarily. So when he takes temporal goods away from man before the end of life, man cannot complain," end quote. Aquinas thinks that there is nothing wrong with being sad if you lose one of the goods that God had given you. He would not say it's, you know, wrong in any way to grieve if you lose one of your family members, for example, or to be sad if your home gets destroyed or if you go bankrupt. No, that's okay to be sad that these are good things that you had and you lost them. It's in our very nature to be saddened by loss, he believes. And he points out, Aquinas, that even Christ, according to Scripture, felt sadness. The point he's making, though, is an intellectual one. At the intellectual level, we have to understand that God hasn't done an injustice to us by permitting our temporal goods to be taken from us. What God has given, God can take away. We are not owed the goods that God gratuitously gives us, and we must remember, as we've seen, God only permits the loss of our goods for the sake of securing an even greater good for us. Aquinas also notes that although God may permit the loss of certain goods to a person, he always gives each and every person what is necessary for reaching their final good, that is, the goods they need to achieve union ultimately with God in the afterlife. Aquinas writes, and sorry, I don't think this one's in the handout, quote, "From the day of his birth, you help him by your providence with the things necessary for his life and glorification, whether they are corporeal or spiritual," end quote. As Aquinas sees it, God would not want to spare the best people from the hardest suffering. It would be like a general who keeps his very best soldiers out of an important battle. In God's providence, the most difficult tasks are given to good people who are able to carry them out, and they are in turn rewarded more in the end. Aquinas writes the following, and this is text 6. "For it is clear that the general of the army does not spare the vigorous soldiers from the dangers or toils, but the whole nature of warfare demands at times that he exposes them to both very great dangers and tasks. After the victory has been won, the general honors these men more who proved more vigorous. So divine providence does not dispose things so that the good are more freed from adversities and labors of the present life, but God rewards them more at the end," end quote. Just as we would not expect a coach to keep the best players in the sidelines or to spare them injury, we should not expect God to spare virtuous and good people from hardships in this life. Aquinas claims that God will reward these people who have suffered much in this life all the more in the end. By suffering much, they will be transformed in such a way that they might be more perfectly united with God than those who may have been spared great suffering in this life. So I'm almost done. The final section, I want to kind of move to the level of analyzing what Aquinas says, raise some challenges you might be thinking with regard to it. And of course, there'll be time to hear what challenges, other challenges you have, and to try to respond to some of those. So analyzing Aquinas' account, there are some critical questions we can ask about Aquinas' view that God permits evil to happen to human beings for the sake of a greater spiritual good. First, one might wonder whether we should remain passive in the face of evil that others suffer. For example, should all of you alleviate the suffering of your patients through medical treatment if God may in fact be using that suffering to work for their salvation? In response to such a question, Aquinas would say that we need to remember that God has indeed commanded us to alleviate the suffering of our neighbors. Although evil can work for good, evil is not of itself good. It's not a good. It can work for good, but by itself it's not good. The medical treatments you deliver to your patients may be the very means God wants to use to prevent an evil that he knows will not work for good. If God wants to permit an evil that we try to stop, our efforts just won't be successful. We are unable to know the complicated relationships that obtain between events in the world and the spiritual state of human souls. Thus, we need to, above all, follow God's commandments to aid our neighbors in need and let God sort out how the events in the world, including suffering, work for the good of human salvation. Another question one might ask about Aquinas' claim that God permits suffering. Oh, and sorry, I forgot to say, on the third and final page, I've listed some of the questions and summarized some of the responses just so you have them for afterwards and can look through them. So another question you might have is about whether this idea that God permits suffering for the sake of a greater good is empirically plausible. We see too many examples in the world of people who don't seem to grow stronger through their suffering. Rather, they are broken by the evil they experience, and they turn their backs on God. So far as I know, Aquinas doesn't directly address these cases, but he does claim that if a person was truly just, God would never permit anything to happen to them which would impede their final salvation. He writes, quote, "God, however, extends his providence over the just in a certain more excellent way than over the wicked, inasmuch as he prevents anything happening which would impede their final salvation. For to them that love God, all things work together unto good," end quote. So it seems, based on this, that there are two possibilities for the case of those who appear to turn away from God in the face of suffering. So first, it may have been the case that they were not turned toward God in the first place, thus their suffering didn't in fact turn them away from God. They just never embraced God in the first place. The second possibility is that despite the appearances, their suffering did somehow, or will in the future, somehow draw them toward their salvation. As outsiders, we're not in a position to judge another's soul. We can never truly know what suffering is doing in a person's life. Lastly, we can ask why God permits humans to sin. If the goal of God's providential care over humans is to get them to heaven, then why doesn't God order the world in such a way that no one has an opportunity to sin? If God knows I'm going to overeat whenever I'm presented with a chocolate cake, why does God make the world in such a way that I'm never alone in a room with a chocolate cake, so I never face that possibility? So Aquinas believes that even sins that God permits can work for the good of the just. He recognizes that people gain greater love and humility through the experience of sin and repentance. We can also learn a great deal that helps us in the future and others in the future from past moral failures. So even our sins can be an occasion that leads to a greater spiritual good. So now that we've considered Aquinas' own views on why God permits evil, I want to very briefly just talk about what he'd have to say with Pat Robertson from the beginning. Remember, Robertson said God permits evil to punish people for their sins. And Aquinas addresses that in the commentary on Job because Job's friends thought the very same thing. They were like, hey, Job, there must be a sin there if you're suffering this much. So Aquinas says this doesn't make sense that God would punish sinners for their sins through suffering. So first he says, a sinner, an unjust person, they're not going to recognize suffering they experience or loss of temporal goods as punishment. So if a very wealthy person who also is leading a very sinful life loses their fortune, they're not going to say, oh, that happened to punish me for my sins. They're actually going to just grumble that something's been taken away from them that they really liked and they thought they deserved. So Aquinas says, you know, this isn't going to really be in someone's interest as a corrective for God to, you know, give them physical suffering as a punishment for their sin, because they're not going to view it as punishment. Secondly, he says that temporal suffering and loss of worldly prosperity aren't even adequate punishments for sin. So when you sin in Aquinas' view, you're turning your back on God. And he says the adequate punishment for that, if you turn your back on God in this life, is to be separated from God in the next life. If you turn away from God in this life, then you'll be turned away in the next life. Losing your money or your health or your family doesn't really make sense as a punishment for turning away from God. They're incommensurate. So Aquinas's point is that, so I'll read a final text from him. In text 7, he says, quote, the fact that spiritual goods are given to the just as better goods and temporal goods are given to the wicked as transitory, end quote. So the just, he believes, receive better goods through their suffering, the spiritual goods, that is, that come from suffering, than the worldly goods and pleasures that oftentimes people who are leading wicked lives seem to abound with. So in conclusion, I just want to summarize a few points and leave you with one other thought from Aquinas. So the key points we've discussed are that evil is a lack of good, which should be present. It's not some positive entity created by God. God created a world of creatures that actively interact with one another, and at times through their actions, they diminish each other's goodness. The loss of one creature's goodness often contributes to the flourishing of another. And we've seen that for human suffering, it's not permitted by God for the sake of some good that goes to another species, but rather God allows humans to suffer in order for humans to receive the greater good of their own final salvation. So I'd like to end with just one final point that's very important. So in this talk, we focused on intellectual questions, questions you can ask with your mind about why is there evil if our world's produced by God? So besides these theoretical questions we ask through our minds by thinking, there's also this human experience of the real palpable distress that people feel when they're suffering illness. You know all about this from your daily work in the medical profession. And Aquinas has something important to say about that experience. Aquinas thought that while God doesn't intervene to stop evil from occurring, he nevertheless is not a passive bystander in the face of people experiencing evil. Aquinas thought that God draws even nearer to those who suffer to provide them with the inner consolation they need to face their sufferings. He writes, and this is the final quote on the bottom of page 3, text 8, quote, people need to be supported in the face of evils which occur, and that is to receive comfort, because unless a man had something in which his heart could rest, he would not stand firm when evils come upon him. Therefore, a person comforts another by affording him something refreshing in which he can rest in times of evil. And although a man might be comforted by something and find rest and be supported by it in the case of some evils, it is God alone who comforts us in all evils. Hence, Paul says, the God of all comfort, end quote. For good reasons, God doesn't intervene in creation to keep us free from all suffering. Yet as this quote reveals, God is neither an unmoved spectator, passively watching those who suffer. God himself draws near to the hearts of those who are struggling to comfort them in their afflictions. God never abandons his suffering creatures. In Aquinas' view, you all who comfort the sick through your medical work, you're emulating God himself. So thank you. I hope we still have some time for questions. Sorry if I went a bit over.
Sense of the evilness between humans. A newborn is abused by parents. Sexual abuse by someone. Things that are very difficult to put into your model.
Yeah.
And very difficult to to forgive from human to human, even with a very big Christian heart.
Right.
And Aquinas doesn't talk about that. It doesn't talk about genocide. It doesn't talk about the cruelty that humans have towards other humans. That's not part of the evil world that Aquinas describes.
Yeah. So actually, he does talk about human sin that we commit against other humans. So I regret, but I actually changed the talk. The last time I did it, I had more about sin, but I came here thinking, oh, you all want to hear about illness and suffering.
Well, that is part
yeah.
of the illness and suffering that we do have
right,
to attend
of course,
to as
yeah.
physicians.
Yeah, so what Aquinas has to say about that is that as creatures with intellects, it follows on this power we have to understand the world, that we have this other power to make choices, that we can understand with our minds, our options, and can move ourselves towards or away from them. And Aquinas thinks that since we have this power of free will to choose, people, it's just radically within their power to make these awful choices to harm other people. So the question is, well, why does God allow that? Why doesn't God stop people from doing that? And Aquinas says that, you know, for those, I mean, sometimes he would say God does stop that, you know, through the agency of other people who intervene and prevent those. But we know of so many cases where it goes on so long, suffering and evil and even, you know, murder, where it's someone's final end. And he thinks that the victims of those crimes, you know, just like the people who suffer illness through natural causes, you know, will receive goods and will be, you know, even in the afterlife, compensated, so you'd apply that same model there, but then he, you know, would talk about the cause being human freedom. So you ask, well, why does God create a world with free creatures? Because the evil you talk about is a lot more horrifying than the evil we find in nature. And he thinks that in order, the whole purpose of why God makes all of this is for humans eventually to be in this state of union with God, and it has to be a free embrace of God. So free will for him is necessary for love. It's necessary for us to love each other and ultimately to love God. And to have that power by which love is possible, it's to have a power by which grave evil is also possible. You just can't separate those two. It's a two-way power. So that's, I mean, along the lines of what he would say for that. And I mean, he's got a lot to say about, you know, the psychology and, like, the development of the person that would lead them to make these kind of choices, and that would be, like, a whole other thing to go into. But he does have a lot to say about that. A lot of it just couldn't fit into all this.
Yeah. I think that one of the most difficult things to think about is suffering that ends in really early deaths for infants and children, especially, it seems like that's a suffering that doesn't allow for virtue development in that individual, or for suffering that causes salvation or personal faith. So how do we understand suffering that ends in very early deaths for people who don't have the intellectual capacity to kind of embrace God?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and you're absolutely right that, like, this account, it's only going to apply to, you know, the account that suffering is going to produce a character and moral development. You know, human beings who've reached the level of maturity where that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, toddlers, infants, if you can't talk about it being for their character development. I mean, Aquinas, you know, there is all these discussions about, you know, what happens to, you know, in the afterlife, to people who die prematurely. And that just more he goes into, like, kind of how, you know, in the afterlife they can sort of develop in certain ways, but the suffering here wouldn't be part of that. So, I mean, I think he'd have to say that suffering that happens to children, it might be for the good of other creatures coming to their salvation. and that those children are going to be somehow compensated in the afterlife for all the, that somehow in a way maybe that we can't understand. There are some, it's not really an Aquinas, but some people I know of who work on the problem of why animals suffer, they have this theory that, you know, we can never know what's going on in another being's mind, what they're experiencing. There's some Catholic philosophers who think that maybe in animals there is this kind of union with God, and like maybe also in infants, like we don't know what they're thinking or what's going on in them. I mean, we do know stuff about brain development, that certain things wouldn't be possible because of the way the brain is, but maybe there's another like spiritual side where they are experiencing kind of an intense union with God and somehow play into it. But yeah, that's a tough question. I think, did you agree with that question?
Yeah. Alex just asked a more elegant version of what I was going to ask.
Yes.
Yeah. More elegantly. Related to that, though, couldn't the argument then be made that if God has these infants here, and then in the time where they are in this intense union before they lose it, develop the ability to reason, make their own choices, and kind of enter into this original sin and make the choices for themselves, couldn't you argue that God is using these infants to then die? And if God loves them, there's free will, He's willing these infants really only to die for the greater good for their mothers or the people who watch the mothers grieve.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's going to be, it's going to be similar to the problem of, you know, just any person who is suffering that they experience is going to bring a benefit to someone else. And Aquinas, I mean, he probably say something about just how the life itself is a gift and that it's not something owed the creature to have that life and those goods, and so it's not like robbing them of something to deserve. Like if another human kills another person, they're robbing them of something that, you know, they didn't give them and can't take away. But in the case of God, you probably think about it in that terms, which obviously, like as a parent, I mean, that would, you know, it's not going to bring a parent any comforting if you say that, and he doesn't mean it in that sense. To be comforting to someone who's experiencing that, but more if we're thinking of abstractly about justice, just that it wouldn't be an injustice that they still, I mean, you know, an infant who dies in that state, Aquinas would have believed if they die, you know, after baptism before they can commit sin, and they are going straight to heaven, and ultimately it could have been for their own good, because who knows how their life could have unfolded later on if they did have a longer life. I mean, and say maybe God foresaw that this child, when they grew up, you know, maybe would have used their free will very poorly. So it's almost like a grace or a blessing to allow them to die young and get straight to heaven. These are very difficult questions.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with the last statement you made about letting them die early, but I would agree that life, Aquinas would probably argue that life is then a temporal good.
What would you say against the last part?
So I believe our souls exist extra historically, and so that's kind of how original sin enters, and then when you talk about the redemption and the resurrection of Christ as kind of Jesus' suffering for us also as an extra, it's a historical event that also exists outside the aspects of, it's an extra temporal event as well.
What do you mean about the souls existing extra historically? Like they exist before they're in the body?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so they exist but then continue to exist, and we're still who we are. And we're not predestined, but
yeah, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just saying that, you know, maybe if a person's life is cut off before they could make that choice to reject God later on, it could actually be a good thing for them to die before they make that choice, because then they're going to be in heaven in the afterlife rather than the alternative. Other questions?
So there's a difficult passage in Exodus where it talks about how God hardens Pharaoh's heart when Moses approaches him. And I feel like that hardening of the heart, which causes Pharaoh to say, no, I won't let your people go, leads to more plagues. So it leads to greater suffering for the Egyptian people, as opposed to we don't know what would happen if God, it seemed like limited free will in that scenario, saying he hardened Pharaoh's heart. And if Pharaoh has chosen something differently, so that's also difficult to understand.
Yeah, so are you getting at the problem? Like, if God hardens the heart, and the hardening of the heart is what causes the sin, and then the sin is what causes the suffering, and then isn't God kind of through these mediated steps causing the suffering itself?
Yes. I think Paul struggles with that also in Romans. He talks about that passage.
Yeah. So, I think what I'd say, I actually, some time ago, I read two really great articles about that passage that I thought were really helpful, but now I can't remember what they said. But one of them was in the context of co-teaching a class with an Old Testament scholar. But I just remember generally that part of what was going on was looking at the original language and the words and what they meant in that language. And I think with any passage in Scripture that seems to raise a contextual, like a conceptual or philosophical or theological problem, a good first step. I mean, I know all of us don't know the original languages and can't go out and learn them, but there's a lot of really good scholarship of people who know the historical context and the languages, and oftentimes what passages seem like they mean on the surface, it's really kind of different. So I know, like, some philosophers will talk about, well, how is the hardening of the heart compatible with free will? I mean, maybe, there are a lot of ways you can interpret it such that it's not free will. It might be something they don't incline him towards sin, but we know God doesn't even incline people towards sin. But there might maybe other ways of looking at it just historically that would be putting it in his free will and not having God inclining him.
Thank you, everyone.